If you meditate like I suggested in the at the beginning with the guidance to keep it very simple, to basically just appreciate this sense of presence, which particularly maybe if you're sitting in meditation and you're in a very safe environment, then it's probably, well, that's why we do this. It's kind of form of meditation, is it's a bit easier, no? You set up this intention, we ground our attention in the body, maybe as good as you can, and then you become aware of this nature of the quality of consciousness. It's just presence, which is like a space in which things happen, the things that that make up our life, which is basically just all the different kind of types of sensations. So remember, the Buddha kind of, he tried to help us, with our investigation by using this kind of schemes, basically cutting up the take of experience in two different ways. One is the six kind of senses, what happens in the five physical senses, which are all different types of sensations, and then the stuff that just arises in the mind. So anything else that arises, which is not communicated through the so-called kind of external senses. And of course, as the Buddha also said, it all comes together in the mind consciousness, isn't it? Which kind of basically sets up the stage in which we can experience what we call our world, our life. And the other one, which is maybe something a bit more complicated, is the five khandhas, isn't it? It's another way of cutting up experience. I'm just not going to get into that now, but I'm basically, again, like distinguishing between form or particularly referring to matter in that case. Well, yeah, what modern science would call, probably would usually call matter, and then perception, feeling, so the felt quality of experience, and again, the mental activities and consciousness itself, sense consciousness, vijnana. So it's two different ways, basically, at dividing up what's happening for us all the time. And that's what the Buddha asked us basically to contemplate, to find out, how anxiety, for example, as one which is a form of suffering, arises in there, or other forms of suffering, what is actually happening there. And it's, with the promise that he said through that, continuous intelligent investigation of our actual experience, we can become wiser about it and therefore create less and less what he called unnecessary suffering around our experience. Of course, the Buddha offered different kind of modes, of investigation, but one of the ways of looking at the essence maybe of what our Buddhist meditation is about, like which is kind of investigation, using our mind to investigate the nature of our reality. What is it actually? How does it work? What is it really? Is sometimes not a very good question, perhaps, because it just takes us into speculation, isn't it? But like, how does it work? That's very important. It's like when you have a car, no? And I mean, that's one thing you can speculate about. What is really a car? The phenomenology of the car, and you can write philosophical essays about it. But if you just want to get it to work, and if you've got a breakdown, then the practical knowledge, that's what the Buddha mostly was interested in, with the spiritual practices, to find out how this thing actually works. So then you've got actually a chance to fix it if it doesn't work properly. Same like with the mind in terms of our conscious experience, our psychology, our the patterns through which we live our life, experience our life, distort the perception of what is actually happening habitually. So in formal meditation, like when we're sitting here, we've got somewhat maybe idealized, in an idealized environment, isn't it? We are looking for a place where it's quiet, where it's safe, so that we can practice that. That's the idea of formal practice. Of course, there are other elements to it, like you can, work on developing particular qualities of the mind consciously that you might feel sharpen the mind as a tool for investigation. No, but for all of that, I mean, things that we can do in formal meditation. But in the end, it comes down, certainly my understanding, also the most essential bit, also what I was talking about, is this cultivating this sense of presence of mindfulness. And I mean, he was saying mindfulness of the body is all you need. There's everything that you need to liberate the heart. Is in this practice. You know, that's all you need actually need in terms of a practice. And so we can do that, look at the different aspects. And whatever else you do with your mind when you meditate, you know, some of us are more like doing type people. You don't want to, you know that we use our time when we meditate, how would you say, productively. So, you know, working with the mind, developing a technique or developing a quality, whether you like to develop kindness of the heart through doing metta meditation, or you have a specific kind of meditation technique to focus your mind. Those techniques, they're basically always samatha techniques, you know, to develop more kind of focused attention and steady attention of the mind, so different qualities that go into that, you know, a lot of different approaches. But to me, with my certainly limited kind of experience of meditation, in the end, whatever you do, it always comes back at this sense of, well, this is it, you know, the sense of presence, and this is what's happening right now. That is a reality that we're supposed to wake up to. That's a reality that we create suffering about, according to the Buddha, because we do not properly understand it, or properly understand all the kind of maybe bad habits that we have developed in our mind, in the way that we rate our experience and the way we interpret our experience. But if the Buddha talks about awakening, awakening is, of course, it's to that which is, isn't it? And that applies anytime, of course, not just in formal meditation. It's just in formal meditation. Maybe we take, if we can, not just the luxury to have this slightly, in some way, helpful environment. It's like if you learn swimming, isn't it? You maybe or you just go to a swimming pool first rather than going into the ocean where there are big waves or something, isn't it? It's safer, easier. But then, you know, if you learn swimming in a swimming pool, I mean, you learn skills, isn't it? It becomes kind of second nature. And then gradually you can get into more choppy waters with it. And that's the same idea that also, even like the way I seem to remember, certainly also the Buddha talks at times about it in the suttas, this quality of mindfulness. So he talked about it in some of his discourses in terms of particular techniques, like mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of the body, and he goes into a little bit, certainly, and so not that much actually, but in what one could interpret as technicalities of developing certain kind of aspects of the mind. But in the end, he said this is like something that we want to or need to, if you want to liberate ourselves from suffering, we want to practice all the time, you know, as good as we can, because what we need to understand is life. Anything that arises as dukkha is unsatisfactory. That needs to be understood. So that's life, is our experience. We're not just alive and sit on a meditation cushion, obviously. And though some people suffer more when they meditate, that's kind of specific meditator sufferings, isn't it? And everything's all right until you sit down and try to kind of control your mind, then the real suffering starts. But I mean, for most of us, ordinarily, most of our suffering arises in daily life, you know, relationships and that kind of thing. And so it's the idea that we develop that. But then, yeah, how do we do that? The Buddha didn't give that many kind of techniques. I mean, there are some people who teach kind of specific techniques about, you know, mindfulness practice in daily life, having a mindfulness bell in your laptop that goes every half an hour, or try to remember to just, whenever you go through a door, you know, open it mindfully and close it mindfully. You can do those kind of things. And it might be useful. I've never been very good at that, I have to admit. So I think it's like also the kind of horses for courses kind of thing, isn't it? As I said, some people are more doing people. Some of us are more, we need something to do. So we feel we actually do something useful rather than wasting our time just sitting there. Other people, some of us, like, and I'm probably more one of those, I feel like usually when this meditation, it's such a subtle thing, because it is about appreciative awareness, and appreciating the quality of awareness, which is the quality in which actually freedom and peace is possible, is a given. You know, to me, I mean, that space, if you talk about awareness as space, it's always there. You know, it's not, I don't have to create it. I don't have to do it. I don't have to make it. I just have to recognize it. And then maybe try to, yeah, make that conscious and somehow relax my stuff, like anxiety, into that. And see how that awareness, it's, it makes naturally space for it. It's just acknowledging what's there. It's not, if you know, any problem that I create out of what arises is always something that I add to it, you know, from my personality. It's not what awareness does. Awareness just knows it's like this right now. So I find like if I get too much into doing mode, I tend to miss that. You know, I miss it up. I'm getting so busy trying to fix myself something that I miss, you know, the peace and the clarity that's already there, that's already available. And I think that also somewhat applies to the approach about what's happening in today life. There's of course again that problem that sometimes some of us, we just if you think about practice and, you know, meditation and Buddhism as practice, we just trying too hard, or our doing or trying comes maybe not from a very useful place sometimes, I have the feeling. The idea of trying, you know, next time I'm going to work, I'm trying to be more mindful. Next time I'm, you know, my daughter gets on my nerves, I'm trying to, you know, just be mindful and catch my anger and just practice loving kindness. Setting up those intentions, obviously, it can be, and it is very useful because it gives you a reference. But we want to be careful with it because I think it can lead easily to a lot of frustration because we just generally, we never quite off live up to our expectations about that. You know, we compare ourselves, we read about, you know, the Buddhist monks at the time of the Buddha, and you know, they all just walk mindfully and then they listen to the discourse of the Buddha and bang, they get enlightened. And what about us? You know, we're just getting it wrong all the time, again and again. Well, how frustrating, particularly in daily life. You know? And then we just run back to our meditation cushion, oh, give me some peace. Yeah. Trying to control the mind to get it calm, to calm down again. If we get into that mode, we want to be careful. I mean, we always have to distinguish between our initial, I mean, that's those intentions, it's not to dismiss them. They're first of all good intentions. But then very quickly in our practice, mindfulness practice, we have to become mindful of where those intentions come from, to which extent they are good, and to which extent they are corrupted by our deluded personality. You know? Particularly this kind of trying hard can be one of those, or the judging oneself all the time about failing again, you know, whether it's trying to get the mind calm and oh, it just doesn't work, I can't do it, and whatever. So like that's always a question. I remember from a Burmese meditation teacher, I think I picked that up, was interesting. He was asking about his disciples, you know, he was talking about awareness practice and the liberating quality of awareness itself. And yeah, well, one way he talked about it is just saying, like, really look at the moment you're in a form of meditation when you notice that you've just been lost again for 30 minutes. You know, what is your next thought? Right? Because the obvious thing should be that you should be, well, at least you should, it's probably not so useful to get really carried away with it, but you could be content because that's a moment of mindfulness. In this moment, you are where you're supposed to be. You just notice what's happening. But so many of us immediately go back into whatever our patterns are. We think, oh God, you know, I'm so hopeless, you know, just another 30 minutes, you know, everybody else looks peaceful. I'm just, you know, doing this. And so, you know, like he was pointing out, you know, when like when you have a meditation where like in 10 minutes of meditating, the first 10 minutes, let's say, of today, you notice like 30 times your mind wandering off into, I don't know, what went wrong with the meal that you cooked today or whatever, or all kinds of things, nonsense. How do you think about such a meditation? It's interesting enough, even with the preparation, you know, preparing people for it, most people just think, oh, it's kind of a terrible meditation. But that's 30 moments of mindfulness in 10 minutes. You know, it's much better than, you know, being kind of 30 all the 30 minutes kind of peaceful, but in a drowsy kind of state where you don't really quite know where you have been when the bell goes, and oh, that was a nice peaceful meditation. Oh. But there wasn't any mindfulness at all, you know. But the other approach, that was what I was talking about, is just to trust. If you just have a regular practice and you cultivate the right kind of attitudes in meditation, like if you want to say choose my line of just keeping it simple, be with the body, notice all the different sensations, notice the space, be kind to yourself, try and develop patience. And you do that, once a day, twice a day, it will spill over into the rest of your life. It might not be so obvious because, in your daily life, that's when you get out of the swimming pool and you're in the choppy waters. And what you notice is that you're swallowing salt water and getting into trouble and all that. But hopefully, I mean, if you've been practiced for a while, you do notice. Well, often we don't really, but sometimes it's good then to consciously remember, how did we actually react or things in situations, to ourselves or other people 10 years ago, if we can remember. And we might say there are differences in quality, and that is just because that quality of presence becomes a bit more steadier, a little bit more capable for us, a bit more stronger, a bit more of a refuge, not just in form of meditation. And then we don't have to always run back to a meditation cushion in order to kind of restabilize our mind, because we start to learn to do it actually more with inactivity. Now, if I do get that, if I'm allowed to praise myself, I notice that with my parents, for example, that's a classic one. It's always said for monks, monastics, the real test is when you go home and visit your parents. Because, for your parents, I mean, my mother was very, very proud when I finally became an abbot. She would always write her letters with, the abbot, But in principle, you always remain the son or the daughter, it doesn't matter what you. And so parents, of course, and maybe for some of you, I don't have brothers and sisters, it could also be brothers and sisters, they're just perfect teachers, isn't it? Because they really know how to push a button. So they don't even know, they just do it anyway. So I do remember when I was a young monk, usually at the beginning, I would only go and visit my parents every 2 years. Later, it became more frequent. Now, I do remember at the beginning, I had to escape the social situation. The problem is my parents is I'm kind of working class family, so I didn't have my own room. So I was most of the time pretty exposed to everybody. I didn't really have my own room. But I did every now and then just kind of extract myself from the situation and maybe got into their dormitory and did some meditation there, or just went out, to get a bit of time on my own. And it's interesting that after a few years, I noticed I didn't need that anymore. I just, it's not that I was, hyper mindful and present or whatever in a kind of conscious kind of practicing way in that sense, but it just noticed, oh yeah, and the mind just became more spacious and less reactive. And so, yeah, so less reactive. And if it's less reactive, then it's more spacious. So you just notice the things happening and buttons be pushed. But it's easier to let it go, not just to get stuck on it or something. And because when you get stuck on it, then it's when it wears you down. And then you start to get tired, and because you always, always with all the kind of stuff that has been triggered for you. If it doesn't, if you can let it go, then it doesn't tire you in the same way. It's much easier to return to a place of relative centeredness and spaciousness without formal meditation. But I think it's a process. I mean, for me, it's like that, and it just needs some trust. And it can be helpful to just consciously pay attention to that also, to, as I just said, to re-examine like the quality of your interactions and your internal state and space throughout your daily activities. Of course, there are some things that we just notice progress quicker, things that before maybe would have upset us, which not a big deal anymore. And the other things that might seem impossible, and the bigger demons, which or whatever, sometimes it seems to be silly, kind of simple things, but that are so ingrained that we don't seem to be able to move past. But even that, I think that is the quality of Satisampajanya, mindfulness and clear comprehension, as to me, the Buddha talked about in the Satipatthana Sutta, is a quality just to develop in any kind of bodily postures, in any kind of activity, not as an obsessive kind of thing. Oh, you know, I'm now like going through the sutta, like you go to the toilet, have to be mindful, you know, everything you go to do in the toilet, a mindful exercise. And yet, I mean, it just gets very, I don't know, maybe it works for some people, but I think it just gets very tense easily. And we easily confuse presence and this concentration. You know, we're trying to really concentrate on what we're doing. And notice, concentration can be a good thing. Focus can be a good thing. But consciousness is obviously a very subtle thing and the different kind of qualities. And it seems obvious that you need different types of attention, different types of, say, quality of attention and different kind of activities or what you're doing. So that can be a problem again if you just read some Buddhist text and get obsessed about a certain kind of idea, what we think we need to that we need to develop, particularly if it's if it's concentration that we're thinking about because of this kind of tension. The problem is then it easily becomes exclusive, isn't it? We're so focused on one thing that we think we think we're practicing mindfulness of the body by noticing our feet lifting, moving, da, 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 and all that. And we don't notice, I don't know, the context, right? We don't notice that we're walking straight into a puddle or something, you know, because we're so focused on our feet. That's a problem with over-focusing. With some activities, we need a lot of focus. But with some activities, we need to reduce our focus. Too much focus is not useful, right? So we need, in a way, that's common sense. But it's surprising how easily, that's another example of just, you know, how our human mind gets to overfocus. You know, as meditators, we can lose perspective of that. We just think we have to develop just one particular kind of attention. What nonsense, you know. You know, if you're in your armchair and read a book, it's a different kind of attention than sitting in your armchair and just relaxing. You know? You know, when you read your book, then you cannot practice awareness of your feet and your arms and your body because you're losing the story, isn't it? You come to the end of the page and you're gonna have to start again because you don't know what you've been reading. Okay. But you know, if you want to sit and relax in the chair, then it's good to feel the body. Well, that's why, you know, if you get lost in a book, of course, maybe after half an hour you come back to yourself and your body is all aching because you haven't paid attention. But so it doesn't mean that it's wrong. It's just different kind of attention that you need for different kinds of activities. So don't be kind of a one trick pony, is it like that? You know, realize that it's good to be dexterous with the mind. It has so many facets. It's part of investigation. What's actually appropriate in this situation? Well, much of our daily life activities was good to have a much wider focus so that we don't get too overfocused on something which we, for particular activities we have to do, you know, if you want to put the nail into the right place and all that. But generally you have to, that's one of the wonderful things with Sati Sampajanya that implies that, you know, that the Sampajanya bit, supposedly, according to the commentaries, implies that you're aware of what's appropriate in what situation. You know, what do you need to actually pay attention to? You know, you've got to, so in most situations, you want to be aware of, I don't know, maybe as much as possible is making an exaggeration, but it's useful to have a broad and open kind of focus, isn't it? And so informal meditation is just something where we can put our mind more consciously to either doing it if you are that type or just remembering, you know, those kind of qualities and try to express them in the way you just sit there. That's a Zen approach. You know, what's it? Zoto Zen approach, isn't it? Just sit there. You know? But it's not so easy to just sit there. It's simple, but it's difficult to be simple for us most of the time. Well, and of course, part of the practice is also we get, you know, to know ourselves over the years a bit better. We know it's part of our patterns. And sometimes there might be particular kind of things that we want to particularly work on, like maybe more in a psychological kind of way, you know, to disentangle some of our maybe unhelpful patterns if we know that they are like particular situations or with people or whatever, or like a lot of people have anxiety with exams, we say in exams, no? I mean, it's a typical one. What could be all kinds of things, no? Why we get anxious about. for different reasons. And it's natural. You know, in some ways, it's just, of course, as a basic quality, it's just a nervousness if there are things at stake. And we feel, you know, if we make mistakes, there might be, we might know or imagine that there are serious consequences, or we feel anxious about it. So, in some ways, it's just a manifestation of that heightened energy, our system, body, mind, encountering a challenge, generating energy. And we might not know very well how to manage that energy, isn't it? That makes it worse, because when you start to feel, ooh, you know, if the energy manifests, it's like with fear, isn't it? And we start to get tense, and that makes us more anxious. And then maybe we sweat, or we get cold, or we get hot, or and then we interpret those signs, and we might get into a runaway cycle, you know, I mean, all kinds of different things. And yeah, I mean, in some cases, of course, that might be worse, you know, if it's long-term patterns, to do more specific work or investigation on those things. But the basic practice, again, to me is of course that where it starts, also the psychological practice, where it starts, and also where it comes to a fulfillment or conclusion in the end, is again this sense of presence, you know, for me in my practice. First of all, yes, if you become familiar to some extent with this sense of presence, conscious presence, which is like, say, space. It's a metaphor, mental space, of course. And if we familiarize ourselves with it, like say in meditation, and start to feel it as a kind of refuge, because to me at least, it has a liberating quality. It's naturally peaceful. It just is. It's just like the sky. Things manifest in it, and but it's, you know, things come and go, but it's just, yeah, it's by itself, it's natural peaceful. So if I start to be able to relate to that, it becomes kind of a resource where I feel, well, what of my experience can I actually receive in that space, or as that space, you know, being that space, abiding a space, without becoming reactive, which is a classic way where we lose that space, which is like we're collapsing into the content of our experiences. And so, of course, with being, if my body is comfortable and I'm just with the breath, and if I don't have a problem already with the breath or whatever, you know, then that's kind of easy. But then gradually, I'm starting to learn to accommodate more and more things in that without making a problem out of it, you know? Because that's always extra. And that's something we can also start to experience in our daily life, you know? And yeah, you always want to be careful, I think, respecting the limitations, so we don't push ourselves naively beyond maybe some objective limitation that we still have, and say re-traumatize ourselves or whatever, you know, by trying too much at once. But then we became kind of, that's my experience at least, we can experiment with that a little bit. Like that's part of the investigation, part of the meditation for me, is if I can connect, whatever helps me to connect to that sense of just spacious presence, and then from there can slightly incline into that space of difficulty, you know, whether it's anxiety or fear or anger or jealousy or guilt or whatever it is. And to be able to maintain kind of a perspective on that and notice, well, it's also just that. What is an emotion in my experience? What is it? I mean, no, it's a serious question. I mean, you should know. What
It's
is
hard
it?
to answer.
Huh?
It's hard to answer.
No, I don't think so. I mean, the way we experience emotions, not some theoretical answer. What is it? Remember, I told you about the two different ways the Buddha cut up, you know, the sensation from the six senses or those five khandhas. There's nothing else that we can experience. So an emotion falls in there. So to me, I mean, if I look at it, and an emotion as an experience is always, there's physical sensation and there's a story that I'm telling myself. You know, anxiety is often a lot of story, but I mean, it can be different. Sometimes this might not be that much going on there. It's just all, you know, sensations, which are very disturbing. But usually, in my experience, emotions become difficult because we kind of get lost in that. That's the content, you know, of experience that appears within that space of our presence. physical sensations in this case. We don't need to worry about sounds or smells or all that. Physical sensations and thoughts or images. And they feed each other. No? I always remember my first meditation teacher was always asking us, what comes first, the thought or the emotion? He never answered that, I think, for a reason. In our experience, usually it's just an entangled mess, isn't it? You've got some kind of feeling, you start to think about it, that thinking creates more feeling. By feeling, I mean now sensed feeling in the body, you know? And they feed on each other. And the less perspectives that we have on it, the less we can actually maintain conscious presence. We get lost in all that activity of the body and the mind. And that's where our emotions can carry us away with them, isn't it? Whatever they are. And some of them, of course, might be quite nice, and we are happy to be carried away with them. But then come the ones that, ooh, you know, here we are again. And we identify with them. That's me. Well, me again, messed up. But I think this meditation, and it might sometimes be something it needs a bit more than just meditation, but that to me is a basic tool, which also in psychotherapy these days. A lot of psychotherapies, they use more and more, of course, simple mindfulness practices as well, anyway, and as a therapeutic means. But it is, because it's just a way of, first of all, become conscious, fully conscious of what is actually happening, rather than always just reacting, acting it out, but just noticing. Oh. And then if you become more stronger in that, and that's what formal meditation is about, to become more stronger in that, then we can to start to be able to hold that and not just believe it, but being able to question that. You know, it doesn't mean judging it. It doesn't mean it's right or wrong or having a theory about it, but just to be able to be with it and really investigate it. So, what is actually happening here and how is it happening? No? And of course, that's our experience also in spiritual practice. We fail again and again. Maybe over the time we just notice we fail less. And we can have these moments where it becomes very obvious. I remember as a young monk once when I felt really, really, really miserable about myself and guilty. I'm not usually guilt type, or maybe not anymore, I don't know. But at that time, I really, really felt guilty and felt I should be wiped off the surface of the earth and, you know, disappear from the universe or whatever, you know, the kind of silly thought that you think. But the thing is, it wasn't just a thought, it just really felt, you know, the body guilty. And then suddenly I just noticed. It seems trite, but it doesn't. It's just a feeling. It's just a feeling. I mean, so what? And we already know feelings are not permanent. They feel at the moment, they feel very real. But then well, okay, so I'm feeling horrible and guilty. And I look at it, and this is just, first of all, the story that I'm telling myself. And then if I stop for a moment and look at it, story doesn't look very, intelligent, actually. Most of my stories are not to do that test. It seems, I mean, as mindfulness practitioners, that's something that we really should have done. And I'm always surprised, like even my fellow monks and myself, you know, been practicing for 30 years and more, how much we just keep taking our perceptions for granted and believing our opinions. Why? If we know it's just a story that I'm telling myself. It doesn't mean that it has to be wrong, but it's mine at least are never, virtually never 100% true. They feel sometimes 100% true. But at the moment, I just remember this moment, and you just need a moment of mindfulness, and you press pause, and you just look at that, say, all right, I'm telling myself a story here, isn't it? And only noticing that you're telling yourself a story, it only just takes all most of the power out of it and says, okay. And obviously the others got different stories, otherwise we wouldn't be arguing, isn't it? And so, well, if I'm just telling myself a story, how do I know that it's actually true? And only asking that question, you know, it's just already I can start to laugh about myself. Of course, usually I'm right and I know it's true, but just by looking at it, I know it's only sort of true, you know. Even if it's very true, it's still just it's my perspective, because we always have a perspective, isn't it? We always look at things from our point of view, and it's just one point of view. There might be there are better point of views than others, for sure. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't have any opinions and all that, but just to notice Just to notice. That's what our mind does. It opinionates, it judges, which is what it's for, and it's useful. But mindfulness is there to keep a check on that, to realize it goes that far, but it's not the entire truth. You know, the reality is not really, is never exactly the way we think it is. In theory, we know that, but in our daily life practice, we tend to forget again and again, particularly in relationships. He did that again. How dare he? And yeah, and then when you just stop and you investigate a bit, you start to see different aspects of what might have happened or not happened, actually. In theory, at least, I think with the stories, it should be easier. I find, well, the feeling bit, like in the body, it's a bit more sticky because it's, if it's strong emotions, it's just, well, that's what emotion is about. It moves you very strongly, isn't it? It's what makes your stories believable. And it can feel very threatening. And like anxiety can feel very threatening. Fear, anger, you know, if it comes out, it's a very powerful emotion. And we don't just want to act it out unfiltered. It's usually not very useful. Anxiety is not useful. I mean, no, it's not that these things are not wrong. They have their place. You know, if you get lost in anxiety, that's not useful, that's for sure. But sometimes it's useful to be afraid. Never to feel any fear probably means that we are psychopaths. And yeah, I wouldn't trust such a person. But you know, this meditation and then gradually in daily life, you just develop, hopefully, just a little bit more space around it. And that, you know, happened. I mentioned the thing about my parents, isn't it? And I mentioned the source. And I remember, like, yeah, public speaking. I mean, that, for example, that's supposed to be one thing that people are most afraid of. Doesn't at the beginning of it, but it depends also whom or what audience you're speaking to, isn't it? If you just got a few friendly people in the room, it's, I find it easy. But I do remember another thing is, it's like chanting is an interesting one. As Buddhist monks, we do chanting, and that's very nice if you chant in a group and there are at least a few other people who have a decent voice. If not, it can be horrible. But sometimes you're going to have to do a solo chanting. And it might catch you unawares, you know, you realize, and somebody suddenly, the senior monk points to you, says, oh, you know, Abhinanda, can you just invite the devas? Oops. And, you know, as we chant in Pali, which is not a language that I actually know, I roughly know what it's about, what we're chanting, but I haven't learned Pali. So it's just, you just trust that you have memorized it by heart, which you have in principle. Now, if you chant in a group, it's easy. You know, if occasionally you lose a bit of something, you just go quiet and the others carry on and then you get in again. But if you're supposed to chant it solo and in front of 400 people, that's still more difficult for me than doing a public speech. I can talk, but I can't sing. So I do remember, like, this one time when I was a relatively young monk in New Zealand. And the senior monk asked me to, I think it was inviting the devas. And it was even like there was a nun there, and it was like because we were doing a chanting in memory of her father or mother who died. So it was a kind of poignant situation. And I said, I knew the chant in principle, but okay, so I just start. And then after two lines, just, mind just goes blank. You know, what do you do? And that's a classical thing where you can use what you've learned in meditation, isn't it? That's certainly in form of anxiety that might come up, you know. And you start to do a solo, and particularly if it's a big sala, a lot of people, maybe no microphone, you really have to put some voice into it. And then the first lines come out well, and then you start to notice a little, because you're a bit nervous, you start to lose a little tremor in your voice. And isn't it, that's interesting, you know, how the mind works. That's what I'm saying about physical sensations and story in the mind. The voice comes out. That's physical sensation, first of all. At first, it feels good, and then you become self-conscious, and then the voice maybe trembles a little, and you become aware of it, and then immediately think everybody hears that my voice is trembling, and I haven't got the rest, so it starts to be a bit flat, and then you start to be nervous, and you're trying a bit harder, so you become tense, and then before you know, the whole system shuts down, and you just want to disappear. Well, in that case, you know, after two lines, There wasn't anything else. So after a while, I just turned around to the CMO and said, "Well, sorry, it's just mind going blank." And so he asked somebody else to do it, and they did it. And did I die? No. Was it embarrassing? Nobody made a problem out of it. I mean, of course, if anybody, me. Well, at the beginning, I felt embarrassed, but that's just me. That's the ego, not that we're interested to look at. That's a troublemaker, isn't it? No, I just said, well, so now it's just an interesting story I can use for a demo tool. It didn't bother me for very long. But once I went through that once, dying on stage after two lines, so okay, we've done that. So I wouldn't say that I never got nervous again, kind of doing a solo chant, but you become much better at failing, isn't it? If you don't, so what? I mean, if it doesn't come up, it doesn't come up. And it's not always so easy with everything, but I think that's the thing about the basic, like the foundation in mindfulness practice as conscious presence with clear comprehension, which means you're not just present, you try to be present intelligently, trying to understand what's going on. And of course, supported by hopefully by all the other elements of our practice, the Buddha did teach an Eightfold Path. So we try to, cultivate wholesome qualities and reflect on, just like we're doing now, reflecting on where we're getting things wrong and all that. So they gradually just become better at not making problems out of things. And it's interesting how that feeds back into each other. If you learn to make less of a problem out of things, you suddenly have more space and you're becoming more present. Because you're not all the time getting caught in reactions. You just notice reactions and say, oh yeah, well, off it goes. And whenever you can do that, you're just available again, just being present. Nobody says that it's easy, particularly with difficult emotions. Difficult emotions are always difficult to experience. And I think we need to, this we just need to learn to just get through them and feel them. The more you can allow yourself to feel those, the less afraid you are of them. If you're afraid of getting anxious, if I'm not afraid anymore of getting anxious, I mean, anxiety is a normal thing. It's not something wrong, the less afraid I get of it, the more space, the less of a problem it becomes. Somebody once said, because there can be, that's, I, none of you, I think, is subscribed to that school. I'm pretty confident, but there can be this idea about Nirvana, just or it's like the popular way of how sometimes Nirvana gets portrayed in pop culture, isn't it? Like when you kind of have taken enough dope or something, then you kind of Nirvana because you don't feel anything anymore, isn't it? Like, get me out of this. Nirvana or the freedom from suffering is not feeling anything anymore. But actually, it's the opposite. It's just to be able to feel everything and anything and not be afraid of it. Normally, our suffering is like the limitations, the inner limitations that we have. No, it's not something to judge ourselves for because there are reasons, in the past. It's not that we are just too stupid or something, but it's we have limitations in feeling and allowing certain things, the ones that things that we find difficult to feel. So we develop all kinds of schemes to defend ourselves against feeling those things, and that makes our life very complicated. If you're not afraid anymore and have actually, and it's not just not being afraid anymore, but because we have developed that gradually, that capacity, we just feel life the way it is. And boy, I know, girl, I mean, it does feel bad sometimes, doesn't it? But yeah, it's stupid. If it wasn't that way, then the Buddha would have been wrong. No? But I think he was right. And so, yeah, it's not supposed to feel good all the time. So it's not that you're failing because you're not feeling good. But you can notice like what's behind whatever we feel, however bad it is, however good it is, that's all part of the show, isn't it? And not to judge it in any way. It's just that is the content of our experience and learning to look beyond that. What is it that is actually aware of that experience? Right? That's where the freedom lies. And I guess my practice certainly is just to try and remember that. Whenever you remember that, it's a moment of freedom. It might not be perfect freedom there, but it's That's the direction.